Well, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure for Judith and I to be invited to speak to you about transformative learning, but as Simon said, more concretely within the prisons context. Now, Judith and I are doing a double act. We're coming at this from distinct but complementary perspectives, which we thought we'd start by briefly outlining. My perspective is that together with my colleague Ruth Armstrong, we have designed and deliver and are evaluating an educational initiative called Learning Together, which is about creating learning communities across prison walls between people who are at university and people who are in prison, and they go and study and learn together within the prison environment.
I'm a teacher by background, and I've recently moved via educational research into starting some research in prisons, particularly focusing on what prisoners read. And I've come to this via some work with former prisoners talking about their educational experiences early in life and how that's affected their trajectory through life.
So we thought we would start by saying a little bit of what we mean by transformative learning. And in this, we've both been inspired by two great thinkers in the field, Jack Mesereau and Paulo Freire. And in their own ways, Mesereau and Freire both describe learning as transformative, when it's what Freire would use, the practice of freedom. The sort of learning that develops in us agency and capacity for critical, independent reflection. The sort of learning that forges new connections, crosses borders. In the words of Adam here on the slide, so Adam's one of our Learning Together students from this year, that reaches in through the prison gates. Learning that really confronts us with different visions of what is, that forces us to reevaluate and reappraise our own experiences. And learning that propels us into the world to live out our lives in different ways, and that generates what the criminologist Steve Farrell has called aspirational hope. And this is an essential emotion to the early stages of desistance, which is essentially the process of going straight. And I'd like really to share two ideas with you before handing over to Judith. The first idea is that transformative learning can and does happen everywhere and anywhere. Moments of learning happen in prisons all the time. They happen between staff and prisoners, they happen between staff and other staff, and prisoners and other prisoners. Transformative learning also happens in unexpected places, as much as it happens in formal educational spaces in prisons. And it happens in moments of crisis and apparent failure. And I am a sucker for stories, so a few brief stories. One of a man called Nick, who recalls a chance conversation snatched with an officer as that officer is about to bang him away for the evening. And as a consequence of that conversation, Nick decides to rethink his life significantly and turn things around. Another man who's in the seg at Full Sutton, and he recalls how an officer showed him kindness even as that officer was restraining him, and how that experience has challenged him to think about how power can actually be used well. And I'm sure we can all think of more orthodox stories of people who've gained things from more ordinary learning spaces. A man who springs to my mind is a man called Gareth. Gareth took part in our Learning Together course, the first one that we ran in Grendon a year ago. At the end of the course, in interview, Gareth recalled talking with a Cambridge student, and he said this. She was like, you could end up somewhere like Cambridge or Oxford to go in and know, actually, these people are talking to me. They're from Cambridge. I wanted to be at Cambridge at one point in my life. And these people are talking to me like I'm normal, like I'm human, like I'm someone they can get on with. It was really quite inspiring. Gareth is now working for us as a research assistant while he's completing his degree. The second idea that I'd like to share with you is that transformative learning is communal. It doesn't happen in one two-hour session once a week, with merely a few books for company. What Carol Dweck would call an individual's growth mindset is vital. That's their will to learn. But Dweck and others' work has highlighted the need for this will to emerge and grow in interaction and dialogue with other people. If you think back to some of your most significant moments of learning, chances are, I think, that many of them will involve others. Transformative learning happens in what Lave and Wenger have called communities of practice. These are spaces and places in which we grow with and through others, through socialisation, visualisation, and imitation. And as sociologist Christian Smith argues in the quote on the slide, it is communities that emerge as real institutional facts, as the foundational social fabric from which we all emerge and flourish. Nick left his cell after that conversation, that snatched conversation that night. Gareth went back to his wing after every single session of learning together. To use some of Ben's language from yesterday, meaningful encounters of learning can plant some seeds, but it's a prison staff and a prison's broader moral and communal climate that can seize these encounters, that can nurture them, and that can make them truly transformative. Everyday interactions can support or can frustrate transformation. Small things matter.
The educational experiences of many prisoners earlier in their life can be a real barrier to learning. But as Amy has argued, prison officers can play a crucial role in turning that round. In an article called "Does School Prepare Men for Prison?", Karen Graham argues that an overall negative experience of school and its psychological consequences has in many ways more profound consequences in later life than lack of formal qualifications. It's the psychological impact as much as anything else. The Ministry of Justice research on prisoners' childhood and family backgrounds found that 59% of prisoners stated they had regularly played truant from school, 63% had been suspended or temporarily excluded, 42% stated they had been permanently excluded or expelled. And prisoners with these backgrounds were, not surprisingly, more likely to reoffend than others. And an important aspect of this is that it is reproduced intergenerationally, both the attitude to school, the experience of school exclusion, and school failure. The Cambridge educational researcher Diane Ray says that the risks of the academic failure and shame that many experience in their early schooling often persist through a lifetime. In her research on education, inequality and social class, she writes, "Shame and the fear of shame haunt the relationships of the disadvantaged to education. And this relationship then becomes part of the family inheritance of disadvantaged children. Therefore, no meaningful learning can take place until these psychological needs are met. And one of the most important elements in meeting those needs is interpersonal. My own research asked what works for people who were trying to find a pathway into university, but whose life story was one of school exclusion, truanting, crime, addiction, mental illness. And what worked for them, I think, gives some insight into what works for many prisoners. The first thing that's essential for learning for people with this kind of background was something they simply described as feeling comfortable, feeling safe in a learning situation, not reproducing the anxiety, the shame, the fear, the frustration, and the exclusion. Not feeling good enough is the greatest barrier for them. And this means it's essential to start at the right point for that person, a place of security from which they can move on. For many prisoners, this means meeting some very specific needs, like dyslexia, unmet educational needs that can be tested for. But for many prisoners, it means meeting psychological needs. It might mean, for example, that somebody is going to learn in a situation that isn't a classroom, that the whole classroom setting is the barrier. And as you know, much learning in prisons takes place outside classrooms. Clearly then, interpersonal relationships, support, encouragement, and understanding are key to what works. Two qualities in particular make a difference. The first is empathy, being someone who can appreciate what it's like for the other person. And a prison officer who didn't have a particularly brilliant experience of school is sometimes the best person for that job. Often another prisoner plays a crucial role, and you'll know, for example, that peer mentoring for reading through schemes like the Shannon Trust scheme are very, very effective. The second quality that really stood out with the people I talked to was they found someone who could be bothered, someone who was really prepared to bother with them over time, consistently, who they could trust and rely on to stick with them, to be interested, to know what stage they've reached, and to help you keep going. Now, this is a nurturing role, what I've been describing, and there's a second stage, which probably is more challenging. The support and the nurturing, although it's essential, is only half the story. Having built up somebody's confidence so that they can begin to lose that sense of shame, they then need to start to become independent. So in a way, the harder part is to do with treating people as adults. This is a challenge that many parents, those of you who are parents, will be very familiar with, or possibly you can remember from your own adolescence. The stage when your children are making that transition to adulthood. In the bumpy ride towards adult responsibility, parents have to judge when to step back. But the aim is to allow the growing adult to become someone who is able to think for themselves in an open-minded way, but also in a way that begins to bring order and direction to their life. It is that exciting business that Natasha mentioned of finding that there is a word, there's a concept for the experience that you're having. It's also a crucial phase in education when pupils and students take on responsibility for their own thinking, internalize their learning, shape it into new ideas. Treating people like adults and giving them adult responsibility over their own life is, of course, an enormously complex and challenging business in the context of prison, where control and authority are at the heart of the system, and relationships of dependence are built into it. So finally, I want to very briefly touch on one more area of theory which I think can be very helpful for exploring this question. That is the theory of recognition, which is found in political philosophy and also key to some educational research. Recognition is a word that's been used very often already, yesterday and today. Perhaps we've hardly noticed, but it's come up time and time again. The philosopher Axel Honneth and others are associated with exploring how recognition in its three forms can change lives. These three forms are interpersonal care, respect for somebody's dignity, and appreciation for their individual gifts. Giving and receiving recognition is part of the work of prison officers and also what you hope for from your managers. Recognition as care was mentioned yesterday, the question, how are you? The personal interest. Recognition as respect for somebody's human dignity, their rationality, the idea they can take responsibility and be an adult. And recognition that comes when you actually know a person and you know what they're good at, know that they can play a part in the world, that they can go out and participate in society. So recognition has these three elements: care, respect, and appreciating individual abilities. All three of them contribute to this early nurturing stage, the child with stabilizers, just learning to ride the bike, but they also contribute to the more adult stage. And they're all things that you're already doing in many cases. Research shows that they can be transformative in education. This also applies to the work that many of you are doing in mentoring more junior prison officers and guiding them in their learning on the job.
So I wanted to finish by reflecting upon some of the challenges of transformative learning as a source of growth, because transformative learning isn't easy personally, socially, or institutionally. Now you may be wondering what on earth a plant cell is doing on the screen in front of you, and I'm going to try and explain. Starting with a man called Richard Sennett, who is a geographer, and his recent work looks at borders, boundaries, and edges in cities. And Sennett's interested about how we build life-giving communities. And he draws on the anatomy of plant cells to direct us to personal, social, community edges. And he argues that just like in cells, the edges of people and institutions and communities are where it's at. They're the most life-giving areas where these life-giving interactions happen. Edges can either be life-giving or, Sennett argues, they can be paralysing. So just as cell walls that are too sealed can cause cells to die, like the cell on the right, Sennett argues that communities that are too closed can become paralysed. By contrast, Sennett says, that life-giving edges act more like cell membranes than cell walls. They provide porosity and resistance. They protect the cells by keeping inside things that are valuable and helpful to growth, but they allow enough goodness in from the outside to sustain growth so that the cell doesn't die. If transformative growth, and therefore also transformative learning, is realised communally with and through other people, then Sennett's work points to the importance of personal and institutional edges as sites of growth. Let me try and tie that back concretely to the prisons context now, because what that might mean is that we might need to rethink prison walls. What do our practices across walls communicate? How do they help a prison to realise its aim and its potential for individual and social good? How might our ideas about prison and our practices change if our prisons became more porous? What might we learn that we otherwise aren't learning? How about if we started to think about walls as bridges more than as walls that keep things out, like cell walls in this cell? It might also mean that we start thinking critically about individual personal boundaries. How do we build the right relationships with each other that are appropriately emotionally and intellectually porous, that don't insulate ourselves from moral challenges, but enable us to attach with one another through our common frailties in ways that make every interaction a source of life-giving learning and growth? Now, navigating some of these institutional and personal difficulties at the edges can be uncomfortable. But what Richard Sennett's work argues is that this is necessarily uncomfortable work for it to be productive, because what it does is force us to all confront our mutual indifferences. Transformative learning then challenges existing power structures. It can lead to powerful and often uncomfortable institutional and individual conversations about legitimacy, about social justice, about ethical communities. Transformative learning is, in some ways, a subversive good. And I want to end with a brief story about one of the people I started with, Gareth. One of my fond memories is of leaving prison at the end of one of our Learning Together sessions and overhearing a conversation between Gareth and a prison manager. And Gareth was using the language of legitimacy to express his frustrations about a prison rule. The manager was looking quite bamboozled, but I left the prison smiling. Because as Alison put it yesterday, to be individually and institutionally good might be to be uncomfortable.
So I just want to end by highlighting some things that we might look at in discussion. And starting with what Amy has just mentioned, because I think it's again a theme that has emerged, the idea that one of the things that's most valuable in learning is being able to name your experience, finding that there is a word or a concept that matches your experience and enables you to see it in a new light. And that's one of the purposes of this 2 days, and in many ways the purposes of all education. So perhaps to take some of these ideas about legitimacy and power that we've already discussed and look at them in relation to learning. We'd also like to think about how prison officers can be role models in learning. And I know from my conversations with some of you that the question of training, of professional development, of finding time to learn, of reflecting on the job, is quite a challenging one in a busy and demanding life. But to be able to say to a prisoner, I'm learning about whatever it might be, and be interested in their learning, is a very powerful message. Where does learning happen? How much of it happens in classrooms, and where else does it happen, and how? And what are the challenges, particularly for prison officers, seeing education as a way of people moving towards independence and responsibility in a prison setting when these things are very, very limited? So we leave you with those questions in the discussion session. Thank you very much.